Hello, this is Blaise Bonpain with a continuation of World Focus coming to you from KPFK in Los Angeles and internationally on the web at kpfk.org. Today I have Judah Fried as a guest. Judah Fried is an international media and politics journalist who has written for the Rocky Mountain News, the Denver Post, the Colorado Daily, and his latest book is called Global Sense: Awakening Your Personal Power for Democracy and World Peace, published by Media Visions Press in Denver. Thank you so much for being with us today, Judah.
Thank you for the invitation to be here.
Surely, it seems that some of the thought there is very Eastern, and we certainly are in great need of that after our Western religious philosophy, but I seem to sense a little bit of good old Buddhist thought there, too, of the internal.
Well, actually, more accurately, be traced to the Enlightenment movement in the 18th and 19th century.
Uh-huh.
The Global Sense is an update of Tom Paine's Common Sense.
Yes, indeed. And I think that is extremely important. We need that at this particular time when we're in a situation we've got to take a new look at what's happening. So how would you apply this to changing the world situation?
The central premise of Global Sense is that we're all globally interconnected. So we have innately built in the power to change the world by changing ourselves. It's the old idea of the butterfly sneeze causing the typhoon, or one drop in a pond radiating out and lapping on every shore.
Indeed. I can certainly see that. But things have to become collective ultimately. In other words, we have to look in, but we also have to look out, right?
I believe we have to look in both directions at once.
Yes, indeed. And I noticed on your book you mentioned many of the conflicts that are going on today, and I feel especially concerned about the two, that is the U.S. in Iraq and the relationship between Israel and Palestine. Those two seem to be intimately related, and what I was thinking in reading your book was the lack of symmetry in the two situations. In both cases, we have a very powerful country and a very weak country. How do we get some sense of proportionality in these struggles?
Well, I think it has to come first from, in this case, from within. If we can see our own selves in relationship to power, how we relate to power, I think a lot of us are afraid to really own how powerful we are because of our global interactivity. And as a consequence of having what you might call a dysfunctional relationship with power, we tend to try and get control of things in the outer world. In the book, I use the expression of authority addiction. This is in the part of the book where Paine was talking about hereditary succession, and I then use paraphrase and redirect his conversation to talk about the issues of authority addiction. And so if we are compulsively dependent on either having power over others or else even being the one that other people are controlling, you know, we can be compulsively the leader or compulsively the follower. In either case, the setup is that one party or one state or one person is in an inferior and superior relation to everyone else, rather than just being able to own their own power, be in balance with the world.
I can see the problem there. I think the greatest myth that we all live with in a place like the United States is our powerlessness. And I think that is a myth, that we are enormously powerful. And I'm not speaking of that in an authoritarian way. Quite the contrary, it is because of, I think, and I think you make this point in your book, it is because of the authoritarian culture that we tend to ask who's in power, whether it's in kindergarten or whether it's in the university or whether it's in the job place, instead of looking at what is correct or what is not correct. So this is a problem of authority and powerfulness as a group.
It's so amazing to me, given what you said, that we tend to put all this energy into who's going to rule us, instead of putting that same amount of energy into choosing to rule ourselves.
Well, that's certainly where it's at. It's a question of understanding the power we do have, and I think that it's important to bring that out in your book, as you have, and you've brought out the abuses, the war on terrorism, and the sense of internationalism. How can people evolve from living nationalistically to an extreme and begin to take a planetary view of living on a very small planet that is in extreme danger, and that in the universe we find nothing like it so far. This is the miracle planet. How can people start to think in terms of this planet?
Thomas Paine actually believed that we're not alone in the universe. He believed that there's other intelligent life out there. I haven't yet seen any sort of spaceship landing on the White House lawn to prove that one way or the other. Of course, if we do, I would be concerned, because the upshot of it might be that we just give away our power to some otherworldly entity instead of still claiming it within. So to deal more directly with the question that you were talking about, one of the things I've created from the book is a report called 76 Ways We Can Change the World Today, and people can get that at my website at globalsense.info, or they can also get there with judahfried.com. And just click on the link. There's the 76 ways. But examples could be choosing where you buy your gasoline, and or even if you're using gasoline, perhaps you're able to convert a diesel engine into something that is able to burn vegetable oil, or perhaps you're able to take your resources and acquire a hybrid car, or perhaps you choose to buy a Segway and go tootling along on the roadside with that. There's a lot of different ways. How many of us are actually bicycling for our short errands that are near home? You know, so there's a lot of things that we individually can do that can send out those dynamic, powerful ripples.
Each one of those things requires an infrastructure. For example, if you live in a megapolis like Los Angeles, biking is a death sentence unless there is a system of bike paths and bike roads. So the concept of biking is wonderful. There's all sorts of things related. For example, I was once told, oh, you can't bike out here in the San Fernando Valley. You'll get bronchitis. It brings up the problem of air pollution, and also the fact that we're structured for automobiles and that bikers are in extreme danger because of the situation.
Of course, when you're talking in Los Angeles, I used to live in Venice Beach, Ocean Park, Santa Monica area, and there was a beautiful bike system running up and down the oceanfront.
Yes.
But as soon as you moved a little bit inland, you were pretty well stuck.
Yes.
And you could take a bus, but the bus system takes a long time to get anywhere in the Los Angeles area. There's a lot of taxi cabs around, but there again, you're still using up petroleum. In Denver, we are now in the process of building a rapid transit system. We've had one for a few years, but it's taking some time to really get the whole system built out. We still don't have a connection to the airport, for example, which to me should have been one of the first lines to build, but they didn't ask me to be on the Planning Commission. But you know, on the other hand, we have an extensive system of bike paths. And the way this came about was by collective citizen action that came about because enough individuals stood up and said, this doesn't work for me. I want a system that does work for me. And I want to be able to ride my bike by the Platte River and not have to breathe all that carbon monoxide and nitrous oxide and all those other lovely pollutants. And so it took individuals standing up and then banding together and doing that collective action. It's that old metaphor that a single raindrop produces the flood, or a single snowflake produces the avalanche. I believe a single voice joined with other voices produces a chorus for change that is irresistible.
We're speaking today with Judah Fried, and speaking about his book, Global Sense, where he is trying to get us to realize the power that we have and is focusing on an integrated spirituality and leading us to global thinking. How do we get beyond being a warfare state? At this time, the United States spends more money on arms than the rest of the world put together. How are we going to deal with problems like that that are a threat to 191 countries at this time?
You know, one place might be just to feel the sadness that comes up when you say that.
Exactly. Exactly. It is a sadness, and it infects our thinking, and it has a deep impact on us on a daily basis. Many people want to simply live in denial of this, but it's quite obvious as we look at what's going on in the world. We have interminable wars and occupations. I mean, we've been in Korea for 56 years, and now it looks like we're going to be in Iraq for 57 years. So these are the problems that I think have to be dealt with as we look at this. And the relationship between spirituality and religion is also very important, because so often religion has been used by politicians as a cloak for malice and as a way to get people to hate each other. And this is not acceptable, and it doesn't have to be.
Which usually helps self-hate projected outward.
Yes, and we must transcend that as well. How do we do it?
Well, again, this says finding that balance between the inner and the outer. I don't know if you had a chance to look at the chapter in the book called, Chapter 7, the chapter that deals with the problems with alpha male rule, how men have sort of taken over the world.
Yes.
And part of that is you can trace it biblically. If you want to root it in religion, you could, for example, look at the Adam and Eve myth, which has various names in various cultures and various people involved. But my personal view, if I can be a little euphemistic and at the same time be explicit, is that I think at some time some mythic Eve got excited by her mythic Adam's rising serpent and spilled the secret of the holy hole and admitted that sex creates babies. And as soon as the men found out, these matriarchal cultures that had existed, if you read Diane Ensler's book, The Chalice and the Blade, for example, or the Mabinogion, the Celtic legends and myths, it's very likely that there were originally matriarchal cultures. And so if that is the case, when the men found out that the women had been holding on to power by holding back the truth, I can easily imagine the men getting very upset and taking power. And one of the things that probably happened as a consequence of that is we moved from cooperative societies to competitive societies. We moved from societies where things were, if not necessarily held in common, but at least certainly there was a more egalitarian willingness to share, to the society were very much rooted in private property, ownership, acquisition, the dog marking its turf, shall we say. We're being a little biologically explicit. I hope this is okay for your listeners. But one upshot of that is that we also went from the female deity to the male deity. And we went from that kind of fertile creative power into domineering aggressive power. When I lived in Los Angeles, I was privileged to hang out with Steve Allen for a little while. And he wrote a wonderful book on religion where he looked at the Old Testament and described the God in the Old Testament as this angry, malevolent, vindictive, jealous God, very different than the God that we like to think of as loving, forgiving, wholesome, that God is all things and good in every way. So we have a lot of myths that I think have built out of this man trying to take over the world. And so I think one of the things that can really change the world is men becoming willing to transform themselves, let go of the need to be in charge.
Well, I think that that's extremely important. And by the way, Steve Allen was certainly a personal friend, a man I admired enormously. But isn't it curious that I hear the word compete about 75 times a day? Mm-hmm. And I do think that the future is going to be cooperative, even as we see in early religion going way back to the Acts of the Apostles. We see the phrase, those who believed lived together, shared all things in common. They'd sell their property and goods, sharing the proceeds with one another as each had need. It's amazing. They met in the temple.
The early church is very different than the church that emerged by the 4th century.
Well, I would think so. It's a tremendously a communal type of thing that is being mentioned here, and we've lost that sense somehow, and many people who think they're religious believe that this competitive way is the way to live. And I just...
It's not only religious belief. It's also a misguided scientific belief, too,
yes.
in my view. People talk about Darwin and the idea of natural selection and survival of the fittest. If people really read Darwin carefully, they can get the understanding that the ones who are the most fit to survive are not the ones who can kill and murder and rape and pillage and plunder and bully others so they survive and all else perish. What he actually said was that rather than might makes right, it's really right makes might, because the one who's most fit to survive is the one who intelligently, creatively adapts to changing conditions.
Well, look at the situation in the animal world. The most vicious animals are in extreme danger of extinction. And those that are the most defenseless, like the rabbit and the rat and so many other animals, are doing just fine. They don't bother people that much. But the tiger's on the way out, and the lion and the polar bear. So the more ferocious the animal is, it seems the less chance they have of survival. Is that not clear?
I think that's a very interesting observation. Also, size seems to be a factor. Look through the eyes of an elephant to see wisdom, and they're one of the most endangered species on the planet right now.
Well, it's really very, very obvious. And so when people talk about things like nonviolence, they may be thought to be unrealistic, and that's what they're called so often. They're called unrealistic. But actually, they are the realists. They are the ones that are dealing with reality. The unrealists, I believe, are the warfare state people that think that you can achieve something through these weapons, and they aren't quite aware of the fact yet that they're going to destroy the planet. And I think it would be nice for them to have an awakening on that.
In a global sense, I talk a lot about both Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And there's a wonderful quote where it says, "You do not choose, nonviolence means not that you choose not to hit the man, but you refuse to hate the man." And that's fundamentalist Christianity in the purest sense. Especially for those holding up a Bible and says, "Let's go to war." Jim Wallace comment, I think.
Yes, well, we've seen a lot of that, the warfare minds of fundamentalists. And it's strange to me that I think there's only one fundamentalism, and that is to say, I have the truth, and outside of my truth there are only devils, and I must kill the devil. So starting with Arnold Toynbee as a historian and others, it was clear that fundamentalism becomes the idea that I have the right to kill, because I'm always killing the devil, just as General Boykin said as he directed our troops in Iraq. He said, "You are killing the devil."
Right. Well, as long as you can dehumanize the other, then it becomes possible to do all kinds of atrocities. I have a lot of quotes in my book from Enlightenment thinkers. There's a quote, I believe it's from Edmund Burke or from Locke. At the moment, I'm not remembering which, but he made the statement that those who make us believe absurdities can make us commit atrocities.
Oh, there's no question.
Actually,
about
it. I think it was Voltaire.
It was Voltaire. Yes, that is one of his many, many great statements.
God is a comedian playing to an audience afraid to laugh.
Yeah, he was also very much in favor of common sense as being very uncommon.
Yeah, and another great line.
That was time for us to latch on to all of this in the midst of a crisis like a nuclear threat on Iran. How do people direct their attention to saying, "I have the power to stop this"? Do I simply make fun of those in power? We have to make a statement that they can hear when we hear a nation threatened with nuclear attack, realizing that such an attack could mean the end of entire nations. It could mean the end of nations in the Middle East, including Israel, because of the start of an exchange that wouldn't stop. People should realize that they become suicidal when they are projecting the use of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. And you've done enough travel that you've seen firsthand the consequences of that.
Oh, constantly. It's just endless. I mean, I can remember sitting in Baghdad just waiting for the bombs to fall and realizing how stupid this was and how it would backfire, as all such attacks have backfired. We have not, I mean, if we look at our own history, did we win something in Vietnam? Did we win something in Korea? Did we win anything in Central America?
Well, let's look historically for a moment. Most of these have been problems the U.S. created ourselves. I mean, you know, for example, Iran had a very stable elected government until 1954. We overthrew that government and imposed the Shah. And, you know, there was a relatively stable government in Iraq until we overthrew that directly and indirectly and ended up with Saddam Hussein in power, who was basically our boy until he didn't do things our way. Same thing you look at, you know, throughout the Middle East. The other thing, if you want to go back historically, is that a lot of these governments that are now up there are not just the fabrications of U.S. and European leaders, but even the borders themselves. Most of those countries didn't even exist as countries until the end of World War II, when the old men of Europe, after Wilson had gone home, crawled around on their hands and knees with a big, huge map in the Palace of Versailles, you know, on the floor, and redrew the map of the world according to how they were dividing up the resources, as if they had the right to do that. It's sort of like the Pope saying, okay, this part of the world belonged to Portugal, that side of the world belonged to Spain.
That's
there was
what
no
happened.
Right, but yet the consequences we live with.
There were. That was Alexander VI in 1492. And he divided the world into Portugal and Spain. Now, we have at this time an entity that was designed to be an instrument of international peace. It's known as the United Nations. Our country has taken a bitterly hostile approach to it since its inception, practically, just as we took a hostile approach to the League of Nations after World War I. And it seems to me, had there been a functional League of Nations, there would have been no World War II.
This is a classic example of how the thirst for vengeance produces consequences. The Clemenceau and it was basically the leaders of England and France were so determined that Germany would never rise again as a military power. They imposed these incredible burdens on Germany that essentially kept its economy weak. And then when the U.S. stock market crashed and then took the rest of the world down with it, it created so much desperation and inflation that the left movement was getting more and more strong in Europe. And so, therefore, those who are afraid of things like that dirty word called industrial democracy, they basically funded Hitler, and they funded Mussolini, and they basically said, if you guys will put down the Reds, it's sort of interesting now the Red states are the Republican states, but anyway, if you put down the Reds, then then we'll support you. I think the leaders that they, Hitler sort of got out of their control in some regards, but it's very interesting because if there had been a fair settlement at the end of World War I, as Wilson originally wanted, Germany would not have been in the position they would have been so subjected to hate from the rest of Europe and so subjected to repression from the rest of Europe. They never would have elected Hitler as chancellor in 1932.
Well, I think that what happened here was there was such a vengeance imposed on the Germans, rubbing their nose into the dirt, that the people finally sought a freak nationalist in the name of Adolf to take power, because he was going to prove that they were not inferior. You know, don't you think that was involved as well in this whole?
Sure. Yeah. That's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah. It's
if you back
horrible.
Me into a corner long enough, at some point I'm going to try and get out of the corner.
Yeah, it's really horrendous, and it is a much we can prove that it's much better to be of assistance to a people that have been destroyed, rather than to take it out on them as individuals when it was their own leadership that was responsible for what took place here.
But I'm so amazed that U.S. foreign policy is not based on really honestly encouraging prosperity. Because when people are prosperous, they do not wage war on their neighbors.
If they were prosperous in Mexico, they would not come to the United States. They're very happy to have been born there. They love their country. But the economic imposition on them through NAFTA and other such things drains their prosperity, and so that they are in pain and they want to come to another country where they can make some money. The short-sightedness of it all is beyond description, actually.
It doesn't make global sense to continue that. It's not sustainable, in my view. So if we were to really consider that the whole world is our abode, that these borders, when you look at the world from space, those borders are literally man-made, and men made them. So if we can just see that the whole globe is our abode, and really start feeling that in our heart and in our guts and in our spirit, then I believe we can find the courage to start saying no to some of these things that are going on and to say yes to some of the more positive things. There's a wonderful magazine that I'm sure some of your listeners read called Yes that really lays out some of the alternative futures that people are actively working and promoting, things that people can do that are success stories. The national news is based on sensationalism and headlines. I mean, I've been covering the politics for a long time to know that the good news stories very seldom gets press unless it's somebody saves somebody from a fire or something. But even then, it's the sensationalism that puts it on the front page. If we can begin insisting for example, how many of us call an editor? Have actually taken the time to call a newspaper, magazine, radio, or TV editor to say, this is what I want. How many of us do more than just complain when they do something right, really give them great acknowledgement and say, I want more of this. I really love it when you do this.
Well, I've been speaking today to Judah Fried, who has written a book called Global Sense, Awakening Your Personal Power for Democracy and World Peace, published by Media Visions Press in Denver. I think the book opens up the importance of realizing that we live on a very small planet that is in danger and that we have to change our way of thinking. Any final thought for us today, Judah?
Main thing would be, one, be willing to claim how powerful you are because you're globally interconnected with all of us. And be willing to practice what I call mindful self-rule and personal democracy, because you do make a difference by design or default. So you might as well do it intentionally. And if people want to get more, I invite people to go to my website. You can get there a variety of ways, globalsense.info or mediavisionspress.com or judahfried.com.
Thank you very much for being with us today, Judah Fried, and we're very much interested in your book, Global Sense. I want to thank my engineer, Mark Maxwell, to thank my producer, Melinda Moran, and to thank Blaise Martin Bonpain for the music. And for a copy of this program, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 800-735-0230, 800-735-0230, or go to the Office of the Americas website, which is simply officeoftheamericas.org. Thank you very much for listening. This is Blaise Bonpain.
Fear, fearing fear, fearing fear. There's a siren screaming in my ear. Election days are colder when pushing from the rear. Is fear, fearing fear, fearing fear. Friends, I've never seen it quite so thick. Minds of clay are now of brick. Montana, Oklahoma, no, revolution is never near. With fear, fearing fear, fearing fear. For men, fearing men for loving men. If ever there was sense, this is the end. Dole returns even money, saying it just might be queer. fear, fearing fear, fearing fear. Just look at any war and you will see. King Herod, Bosnia, 39 in Germany. In each their own time, in each their own gear. They had fear, fearing fear, fearing fear. Buchanan, Duke, Gingrich, Limbaugh, Helms. Creeping like Freddy on streets of Helms. Stealing the wheel for a car they cannot steer. With fear, fearing fear, fearing fear. Prophet that walked the world agreed. Pick anyone that you please. They say invite difference, and away we'll surely veer. From fear, fearing fear, fearing fear.